I would like to say a few words about our responsibility. You know, as Christians, we too bear a certain responsibility. Not only I, who am speaking, but also you who are listening and who likewise profess Christianity. Our days are very evil. We find ourselves living in a very troubled age. It is essential for every person, and above all for every Christian, to take a stand and know exactly who he is and what his mission is. If one reads the Sermon on the Mount, which is found, as you know, in chapters 5, 6, and 7 of Matthew, one will discover that things are not going so well. We have almost no real connection with Christianity. As I read this fifth chapter of Matthew, I find in verse 13 the following description of the Christian given by Christ himself. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its savor, how shall it be made salty again? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. When your surroundings happen to rot and become foul, do you truly salt them, or do you bless their rottenness? Or by glorifying that corruption, do you lend your support to destruction and decay? This is what it means to be a Christian only on paper. Salt has a purpose. Have you ever seen a kitchen without salt? Have you ever seen a table without salt? Salt seasons food and gives it flavor, but it also keeps it from rotting. You salt something so that it will not begin to smell. If you leave it unsalted, it is ruined. These are the very qualities that Christ gives to the faithful and expects them to possess. Truly, the believer must be, in word and deed, the salt of the world around him. And yet today we see people coming out of homes that are called Christian who have no communion whatsoever with Christ. This proves that the salt within those homes has lost its savor and no longer seasons anything. It has gone flat. It has lost its power and effectiveness. I wonder whether the same thing is happening to us, or do we imagine that salt is meant to remain in the salt shaker? It is not meant for the salt shaker. It is meant to be used. Meanwhile, others are left to decay and give off their stench, becoming the cause of still others being destroyed as well. This, too, is one of Satan's devices. He confines the Christian and keeps him in his place, telling him not to expose himself, not to cause trouble, not to become upset, not to enter into disputes, and not, supposedly, to hurt people who are in fact spiritually corrupt. They may not be corrupt according to the world's judgment, of course, but they are according to Christ's judgment. For the world reasons falsely about many things. What appears great and glorious to us is very small and foul in the eyes of God. Do you remember that story of Saint Macarius that I told you about once? The one about the angel and the novice meeting on the road? To the novice, what stank was the ripped open carcass of the animal, but to the angel, what stank was that woman coming along from over there painted, with her hair cropped short and bare, literally bare, in the fashion of the world. God sees things one way, while we human beings see them another. Have we first asked Christ whether he agrees with our way of life? A strange judgment awaits us, my dear. On that day, you will hear accusations coming from places you never expected. Take care that you do not become preoccupied with an olive pit or with whether oil or bean soup appears on the table. Other matters will consume us. The believer is responsible for how he lives and what he does. Christ says, I came to bring a sword upon the earth, and again, I came to set a father against his child. I came to separate, he says, the son from his father. I came to separate the daughter-in-law from her mother-in-law. And someone asks, why would you separate them? You are love. And he answers, I am good love, not bad love, because you human beings have bad loves as well, and bad discords and good discords and bad harmonies. But not like this. So I ask, why has this society come to such a state? Isn't it made up of us? Aren't many of them our own people, relatives even, acquaintances, friends? What have we done as salt in the face of this rotten society of today, which day after day no one is able to hold back? Why? Because the faithful make no use of the salt, or else they are not salt. They think they are, when in reality they are not. In Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 18 and following, it is written that a person will be judged for another person's sins if he fails to fulfill his duty of admonition. If someone does offer admonition but is not heeded, for there are indeed times when we speak and people do not listen, then he is free of blame. But if he does not admonish the other person by his conduct, by his words, or by any of the countless means he could use, then he will be condemned as though he himself had committed the sin. Although he did not commit it, he will nevertheless be condemned. Christianity goes to the utmost. It is not a middle way, nor is it something bland, neither a little hot nor a little cold, neither lukewarm. It goes to the utmost, and in such cases a person must be prepared to go to the utmost for the name of Christ and the salvation of his soul. At first, perhaps, they will not understand that you are acting out of love, but later they will see it, and they will call you blessed. Otherwise, they will say, "A curse on my relative, too, who knew something and never told me anything, and on my mother, my father, and my brother." For many people, out of a misguided kind of love, a passionate attachment, not a love concerned with salvation, do not tell the truth. Often we fail to remind certain people, even when we have the right to do so, and we do not correct them. Instead, we say, "Come, let us keep things pleasant between us, so that we may have..." Thank you, let us understand this properly. Correction is directed downward, not upward. We do not rebuke those above us. We make an appeal to them. Correction is for those below us, where we have responsibility. We have reversed these principles, and instead of receiving a blessing, we receive the exact opposite, a curse. So I say that we are not fulfilling the role we ought to fulfill. Satan has confined us within our little selves. Look after yourself and nothing beyond that. Shut your house and let us go inside. Yet you would not do that if there were a fire in the neighborhood. You would not shut yourself inside and go off to rest. You would take an interest because the fire would spread. A person should be incomparably more concerned when there is a spiritual fire. Yet he must not present himself as a teacher. Always with tears, always with prayer. Give me wisdom, Lord, to say a few words. Open my mouth. Put salt on these words of mine. Let them be seasoned with salt, so that even if a person's pride won't let them be heard now, at least in time they may bear some fruit. Often we do not do this because we are embarrassed, and begin calculating, am I the one who must pull the snake out of its hole? Well, who will pull it out? And when you are called upon to pull out the snake, you think that if you go near it, it will devour you. It will devour you. The aim is to entreat Christ and help the person who is entangled by the serpent understand that he must cast it off. If Christ now permits you, instead of receiving thanks, to suffer some painful consequence, whether in your work, your position, or your ego, do not be surprised. Did Christ conform himself to that world so that they would not raise him upon the cross? No. He went forward and continued all the way to the cross and all people. All those whom we venerate today as saints found themselves at this crossroads. They came into conflict with the world, with their families, with their parents, with the powerful, with everyone. They even gave their lives, and yet they entered eternity. How will we be judged when we were Christians only on paper? I believe that the condition you see around us exists because of us, because we do not care enough and do not love Christ as he commands, with all our soul, all our mind, all our heart, and all our strength. We love him only partly and in our own way. We have not offered ourselves to him. Yet there are countless ways to remind people of these truths when they do not understand how matters really stand. If you examine Christian homes, you will find that they live 100% according to the world. If you examine Christian homes, you will see things that are opposed to Christ. You will see Satan rejoicing. I remember an incident I heard about the other day. There was a young woman who wanted to become a nun, but her family and relatives did not want her to go. Her father had dedicated her to the monastic life because she had been gravely ill as a child. Her coffin had even been prepared, and yet she survived. When they told her about the vow, She said that she wanted to go with all her heart. But the relatives and her mother reacted against it. Her mother threatened that she would kill herself, that she would do this and that. So the father went and took a girl from the orphanage, and he raised her and sent her to the monastery he had prayed about. And he himself later on went and became a monk. But the daughter, the bride of Christ, is now getting married to a man, and the mother, the father, and two or three of the leading figures among the relatives are watching the bride get ready to leave the house. There were cars, plenty of money, every kind of fuss and preparation, but at the same time, all sorts of black figures, dogs, mice, and other rulers of the world of darkness, were bowing low before the father, and before the mother, and before the other three. Thank you so very much for getting her ready for us, for handing her over to us, and not to that other one. Do you see what happened? There was an uprising, and yet once again they stepped in, and the marriage went ahead. In the end, she lost her mind. The poor girl. Behold the results produced by so-called Christian people, though at least one side of their house was covered with icons. And this is nothing compared with all the things opposed to Christ that are done by Christians. As I've said before, Christ and the Most Holy Theotokos are nothing more than decorative figures. They have no say. No one asked them how we should live, or how we should live through these things, and what we should do. That is why Christian families today have, for the most part, stopped being salt. The salt has lost its savor, and this world cannot be salted. Who fills the cinemas? Christians. Who fills the tavernas with all their corruption? Christians. Who supports today's beatniks and the others, the long-haired ones, Christian households? Which homes are these that have girls and ladies dressed in trousers? Christian homes, the very ones whose members hold a lighted candle at the resurrection service. Is this salt then? Does it truly stand against the threat, does it, or does it not? Yet this is what Christ has appointed man to be, the salt. Today he is no longer salt. The salt has disappeared. Out of 1,000 Christians, I dare say, only 5 or 10 are willing to resist. They disregard everything else and humbly follow the path. We have not even prepared ourselves for what we may have to suffer once Christ chooses to remain close to us, nor for what we or our loved ones may have to suffer when they choose to be united with Christ. They do not understand these things, and they are lost. Here is another similar incident. At a celebration for the catechism classes held in the diocesan headquarters, 2 young girls from the catechism school came with their hair uncovered. The other girls attacked them. They rushed at them like furies, ready to claw their eyes out, simply because they had left their hair uncovered. They returned home in tears, saying, "We do not know whether we should go anymore. How can we stand against such a situation?" This happened inside the metropolis itself. How, then, can salt that no longer exists be regarded as salt? How can it preserve society or prevent the destruction taking place every day? It cannot. The salt is not there. If you look at Christian homes today, you will see those antennae up on the roofs, and you wonder what they are teaching and what teachings they are bringing into the home. The Christian is himself both a transmitter and a receiver. He sends up to heaven and receives from heaven. He has no need of those other things, because they are not put to good use. If they were used well, that would be wonderful, but they are not. And yet this school of Satan is there, although there is no money for medicine, no money for people who have been driven from their homes, and none for those who are hungry. But there is money for those antennae up on the roofs. There is money for them, and these are Christian homes. I am not speaking in a pagan state. I am speaking in an Orthodox country. Indeed, I am speaking in this very land, where Paul first preached and brought the gospel here to Athens. This is Athens, you understand whom I am addressing, and yet we so-called Christians dress in certain ways that make us cease to be regarded as Christians. How do we do this? By acting in every way contrary to what our position and calling require of us to help people. So we are failing in this first responsibility toward them. Indeed, many do not even condescend to concern themselves with the so-called lower classes. They concern themselves with the upper classes, although often those who are outwardly higher are inwardly lower than those considered beneath them. We are called to see souls, whether clothed in rags or in silk, whether dwelling in a palace. We must see souls whom we are appointed and called to enlighten by word and deed. For people are all one from below, upward, through our prayer, our patient endurance, our life, and our example. For example, there was a young man living in the pagan household of a powerful master who owned many slaves. The young man was regarded as a figure of ridicule because he was a Christian and fasted. Yet through the practical wisdom God granted him after prayer, he became the means by which his master was converted and became a Christian. The master would say to the boy, "Why do you fast?" And he would answer, "Because I am still subject to evil. I have not died yet. And since I have not died, Satan fights against me, so I must fast." "Then why does he not fight against me, since I do not believe? Why does Christ not protect you? I neither fast nor believe, so why does Satan not trouble me?" The boy replied, "Because you are dead. That is why he does not trouble you. I am still alive. I have not yet succeeded in dying to myself, and that is why he troubles me." The master could not understand this. So one day when they went hunting, for the master was a hunter, he told the boy, "Take care to gather whatever I shoot." They came to a lake, and many ducks rose together. The master began firing. "Boy, run, run," he cried. The boy ran and gathered the ducks that had been killed. "You think you are clever," the master said. "Why are you gathering the dead ones? Run and catch the half-dead ones, the wounded and injured birds. Leave the dead ones. We already have them for certain." Anyway, once it was over, the master sought him out and said, "Now I will deal with you. Do you think you are clever? You are foolish." "We are not foolish at all, master," the boy replied. "We are very wise. I did this to show you why the devil does not trouble you. You are already dead and securely his, like one of those dead birds. But I am like a wounded duck, still only half struck, and he must chase after me to catch me." This wise lesson, together with the boy's humility, and all his words became the means by which the master was converted and became a Christian. The great and distinguished could not win him, but the wisdom of this young boy did. Every person can play a part in bringing illumination. Everyone can season a gathering with salt, season the family, and bring wholesome savor to those around them. But we either keep silent, or we are often worse than they are. And even if we do not fall into the same sin they fall into, we fall into some other sin. Someone else. I was giving a talk at St. Andrew's Church in Cato, Patesia, and while I was speaking, I noticed a woman down by the door. I saw her having a heated exchange with one of our own, as we might say, one of the regular sermon goers at one point. The woman who had come in said to her, "Go away." I could not hear the words, but I saw the gesture of her hand. Later I learned what had happened. The woman inside, the religious woman, the Christian, had rebuked her for coming in with short sleeves, with her arms bare. A woman came into the church immodestly dressed, and another woman told her, "That is forbidden," the first replied. "So this is forbidden, but you are permitted to have your hair cut short. Do not examine what I do, while telling yourself that I must not examine what you do. Is there any difference? Is one woman allowed to cut her hair while the other is not allowed to expose herself? Why? Where did you find such a rule? You see, when you yourself are not spiritually whole and in some respects serve as an instrument of the devil, you are in no position to speak a word of correction. Your word has no effect, even though you may claim to have found it in Christ. You are a Christian. How can you do such a thing? The other day I saw little Nectarios holding his pencil like a cigarette. He was holding it this way. I said to him, 'Why are you holding it like that, instead of the way the elder taught you?' he asked. 'Why?' I told him, 'That is how people hold a cigarette, and it is not good.' 'Oh,' he says to me, 'Father Nicholas smokes. How can it not be good?' Nectarios is 5 years old, mind you. Father Nicholas smoked, so it must be good. What could I say to him? What did that salt accomplish there? We understand what happens. The salt ceases to be salt, and then you cannot speak. How can you go out afterward and admonish anyone? You cannot even admonish your own children, madam." The other person will answer me back, "What will I say then, do you understand?" That is why I do not know which of us can stand before Christ's declaration, "I make you the salt of the earth," Christ says, "I know the filth that exists. I know the corruption that will continually eat away at society. But what will you do? How will you stand firm? And you know that if salt is left exposed and is not carefully preserved, if it falls into water or something else, it loses its strength. That is why it must remain whole. It must remain pure. It must retain the property God has given it together with its strength, and it must be used properly if it is to produce results. If a person does not possess these things, he cannot be called a Christian. This is precisely why prayer today is not heard. This is why we receive no answers, and why we see the things we see. Our first duty, then, is to be the salt of the earth. Second, you are the light of the world. He says that you must be not only salt, but light at the same time. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Salt, light, and a city. These are three qualities that have greatly faded in the Christian. The believer waits to see another person, a true believer, so that his own faith may grow and be brought to fullness. The unbeliever looks all around him and reaches out for something to hold on to. But when he sees someone worse than himself, what can he do? What will he find in us to hold on to when we make no effort to be brought to fullness, so that we may become true guides and lights of the world? A woman wanted to speak sternly to her daughter, but the daughter said, "Mother, have you forgotten what you used to do all over Phaleron?" What could the mother answer? What could she do? She had no answer at all. Her mouth was closed, and she was put to shame before her daughter. Am I not being clear? When we go to church, we enter a tradition, the tradition of the Orthodox Church, which has a whole living history behind it. As soon as we enter, we take a candle, some a small one and others a large one, according either to how much money they have or how cunning they are. Some drop in a 5-drachma coin and take 3 drachmas back in change, and others drop in a little 20 lepta piece and walk off with 20 drachmas worth of candles. And some take candles without putting in anything at all. Oh yes, we have those too. And others drop money in there that you can't spend anyway. This candle is meant to be kept in a resort. I do not know whether you have noticed it. The candles are not kept standing upright, but lying down. This is a confession of faith, which a person takes and goes and lights on what we call a manualion, a candle stand. This dead thing now appears clothed in light. It gives light. It works for the good of everyone around it. And if you actually hold it in your hand and go down into the cellar, you can see. And there it melts away, little by little, on that altar, without leaving anything behind, and without crying out, "Do you see me giving light?" It benefits others, offering them everything it has within itself, without expecting anything for itself. It melts all the way down. All this is connected. The candle is a symbol in our own confession of faith. Each of us takes a candle and places it on the candlestand, which is a type of Christ, of the Holy Trinity, and of the Incarnation. By doing so, we declare that we who were once dead are now alive, and that we who were once in darkness are now filled with light. We who were destined for hell now become a blessing to others, giving them light, and we offer our very selves. Ourselves at the service of the other. Our daily routine is not what it ought to be. Our remarks, our jokes, our doxologies, the praise we offer God, our gestures, our food, our clothing, the way we walk, our whole life, none of it is luminous, it is dark, and because of us, people cannot become people of God. There was a brother whose other half, whose spouse has now fallen asleep, and he had gone somewhere. This couple had gone one evening to the cinema in Chilandri. Now, there was a widow who had 2 daughters, and their mother told them not to go to the cinema, and she held up this couple as her example. "Mum, do you know that couple?" "Of course I do, my children," she says. "Those are fine people, people of real stature." "Well, yes, but last night they were watching such and such a film in Chilandri at the open-air summer cinema." What light are they going to give now? they had become darkness. Were they guiding people or leading them astray? What use are you to me, even if you go up to the podium? What use are you to me, even if you give talks? What use are you to me? Here you cross yourself with one hand, and with the other you serve the devil, and you become the cause of other people's ruin instead of guiding them. Because the dear mother would say, "Have you seen a single Christian here, my child? Have you seen one? They're all half naked, every one of them. But do you see that couple up there?" Those two she would point out to her daughters as the example, as the mark they ought to be aiming at, you know. And yet that couple became the gravediggers of those two young girls, driving a knife into the poor mother's heart. The girls had only been waiting for an argument, and now they used that couple against her. Then there is the religious woman who goes about in Christian circles, listens to words about Christ, and later goes to the hairdresser. How can she be an example? How little her religious devotion amounts to. Let her consider how she enters church. Where have you heard or seen such a thing? Does not the Apostle Paul say that when you come to church, your head should be covered? Must I wear a hat? If you can, wear a hat, otherwise put a covering over your head. Cover your head, lest you show irreverence toward the holy things. Cover your head, the Apostle Paul says so. And when you go against Paul, you cannot go to church or set an example for the other women, whom you cause to stumble. And you can't be a complete example for your own child either. How can you possibly tell your child not to smoke? When you yourself sit and gamble, how are you going to show your child not to follow the road you're on? "I have set you as a light," he says. "You are a light." But no, not only am I not a light, I actually cast darkness over people. Are these things true or aren't they? They are very true. There was a woman in Athens who belonged to a Christian group. At her daughter's request, she brought back from abroad an indecent record. It was an immoral record whose importation the state had prohibited. Yet she brought it from abroad and kept it hidden inside her clothing until she had taken it through customs. This was a friendship from a Christian circle in Athens. "You have to see what I brought you, what I brought you." Kisses, hugs, the whole thing. "And what did your friend bring you?" An indecent record from abroad, one that is banned from circulating in Athens. A Christian mother. "There's a dance being thrown in the neighborhood." "Excuse me, but I don't let my girl go just anywhere. I want to see what kind of house it is, because I won't have it. I hear they turn the lights out at night," and so on. "Come and look, ma'am. See the place your girl will be coming to." So she saw the lights on. And then the lady went off with her mind at rest, satisfied that she had checked where her daughter was going. But she never checked where that girl was until morning. "She's my girl," she says. "As for the lights, we pulled that trick ourselves once. We know exactly how it works. And what happened? The girl gave in to weakness. And what went on in there once they were inside? I can't speak of such things from here." How is this possible, then? When God appointed you to guide your household, to be salt, to give light, and to make that light visible, where did you struggle for salvation? What did you prevent? What did you heal? What did you do? Tell me. Would we be seeing the things we see out there in the world if each of us actually took a stand, each one of us according to the strength he has, if we stood beside people instead of not caring, and if our silence were not blessing this whole situation? We think it's beneath us, don't we? We look down on them, yes, but that man has a pearl inside him, and it is called a soul, and it is worth giving yourself for it. All right then, you're not interested in him, but his soul, his immortal soul, the soul I died for, you're not interested in that either. Wasn't it worth to you what it was worth to me? To you it was worth nothing. Many of us could have played a great part. If only we had had the zeal to do something. We didn't do it. And so we abandon people and allow them to be dragged down by lawlessness, ignorance, and weakness without intervening in time or doing anything to help. I remember an elderly preacher who pleaded with a prominent man to establish a refuge for homeless children. It would be for both girls and boys, so that they might receive as much guidance and education as possible. Out of 120, or 30, or even 10 children, whatever the number, surely someone would have changed. But the man would not agree to it. He gave another little smirk. And in the end he said, I don't bother myself with those rags. And the story goes that the other man picked up a clean white sheet of paper and held it out in front of him. And he says to him, Do you know that this white sheet is made out of those very rags? Because in those days that is truly how such things were made, out of rags, out of scraps of old cloth. Do you understand? It was for these rags that Christ came into the world. Into the world. And if we do not do it, we will be condemned one day. Of course, the question comes to each of us, what can I do? Perhaps you want to cry out, even as I am speaking now. What can I do? I cannot tell you what you are capable of doing. I cannot judge your abilities. I know only one thing. Since Christ still allows you to remain here, you have some role to play. Either you must make yourself true salt, true light, a true city, and then you will shine naturally, and others will be illumined, or you must ask what role you can play in someone else's life. But you must ask, where can you help, and what can you do? Do not be impressed simply because I am speaking at this moment. You too can speak in your own way, and you would have much to say if we spoke privately about the many occasions when you did speak, even though you hesitated, and afterward asked yourself, where did I find all those things I said? Say these things again and again. You may feel that you do not know how to say them, but still say them. There was once a time when you yourself had fallen so low that you could barely drag yourself along. Yet Christ brought you into the church and enabled you in turn to benefit others. I did not hear them. Say them, if only so that the person may hear them. A word is spoken so that it may be heard. That is the whole point. He may hear the words without truly receiving them. Yet I am deeply struck by what is written in Isaiah 55:11. It shall by no means return empty. You must speak the word. Who knows? The person may be saved if he listens, and if he refuses to listen, he leaves himself without excuse. Speak humbly and with supplication. Fall at his feet, weep and persevere. Then you will see how you can reach him. We do so, that is true. Many times we say a great many words, but we speak like schoolmasters. That is sinful, and such seed bears no fruit. Those who sow in tears shall reap with rejoicing. They sow the seed, but they also water it with their tears. Here in Katsipodi, there were two sisters-in-law who had not spoken to one another for 14 years, so that they would speak to each other again. And when a certain Christian woman heard about it, it grieved her so deeply, and probably, though this is only my own opinion, it was God who had put that concern in her heart, and she began all by herself to do 40 paraklesis services, the service of supplication to our Panagia, with tears, with sobbing. I'm waiting for it. I'm waiting for it. And when she had finished the 40th paraklesis, she picked up her shopping baskets to go to the market herself, to the open-air market, to do her shopping. And on her way there, she sees the two sisters-in-law. Yet one day the two of them were seen carrying the same basket together and walking toward the house. Who among us takes an interest in such matters? Who humbles himself to become involved, and who has ever done such a thing? See what miracles Christ works. He has entrusted these things to our hands. I expect it from you, he says. I came down once, and now I have left you to continue the work. As the Father has sent me, I also send you. You will play a part. Think of the Father in the Old Testament. I'm writing a book about raising children and about relations between husband and wife, and in my research I found this. If a child does not obey his father in matters of faith, the father is to put him to death. It speaks of the right to put the child to death. Yes, that's what it says. But you told the child that fornication is a natural thing, and you went along with it. You found your son with his girlfriend or your daughter with her boyfriend. Well, that's what the child did. And what did you do, so now you're going to kill the child? You'll take the child outside and put them to death once it's proven that they won't obey the things of God that you point out to them. Do you understand? That's not what it means that in order for you to believe in God, you should kill your child. And again, if the child breaks faith with you as well and won't listen to you, whatever you tell them, are you going to kill them? Sit down and think about what you yourself have done. You must think about it, God says to you. I made you a higher being, and for things that you consider trivial, I will call you to account. So for what reason? For what reason? How did this happen? Why? Your wife? What happened there? How did I give her to you? And what became of her? The why of it? And so, while there is still time, we have to admit that we have made a tangled mess of this business of our life. We haven't taken our stand where we ought to. A Christian is obliged to take a stand. Just as you do when you see a fire, you take a stand. You pick up the phone, you dial the emergency number, you call the police, you call the fire department. Maybe they're asleep. Maybe they don't even have a phone and the whole neighborhood is burning. And then he goes on his way. So what should be done when souls are being destroyed? We have an obligation to enlighten people. Careful, this here isn't right. Careful, that isn't right. Whatever we can, we should gather up. If you see them lying around, go and collect them, so that careless and unsuspecting people don't fall into the trap. Yesterday I was speaking with a friend, and he told me I went to a hospital in Kifisia, and as soon as I entered, I saw a Protestant copy of the Gospel. I took it and put it in my pocket. I do not believe I did anything wrong. I have about 15 of them at home. He did well to burn them. For example, one night I went into the hospital where I was staying, and I came across The Life of Karpos, you probably know it, a Protestant book, an old one, that has resurfaced now, and I quietly gathered them all up, because every single bedside table had a Protestant Life of Karpos sitting in it. I made a whole operation of it, a carefully organized plan for how those books could be gathered up and taken away, to be burned and removed from there, so that innocent souls, knowing nothing and newly arrived from their villages, would not be lost. Otherwise, they might be caught and destroyed in the nets of Protestantism. Have you ever done anything like that? What have you done? You enter a house and see all manner of false worship. Do you sit down and speak about it? What were you placed there to do? Did you ever admonish those people? You get into a car and see an image of Christ placed on a horseshoe. You see the good luck bead. Did you speak to the driver? Did you say anything to him? What did you do? You simply carry on and leave it to others to speak with him. Do you stop? Will you say anything to him? Why did God place you amid all these different circumstances? What did he appoint you to do in each one? Yet, despite everything, the darkness grows deeper. A leaflet has been circulated announcing that, beginning tomorrow, the newspapers will advertise something. A dictionary of perversion is being released, translated from abroad, from Sweden and elsewhere. From A to Z, it contains everything connected with the flesh, the young, the old, everyone. And these people have the audacity to write an offering to the Greek public. All of you who still have some religious concern, all of you who still stand in fear before the throne, those of you who have access to those in authority, where you are able to exert some influence, speak with the Prime Minister and the Minister of Education, with the primate, and with everyone concerned. Gently and humbly point out the harm, the destruction that is about to come. You must not remain silent. The evil is about to be brought to completion. Nothing will be left. If you were to see even the indecent photographs that are out there, you would be horrified. You may say to me, "Alas, what else is being circulated in secret that we know nothing about?" That too is true, but at least we must protect unsuspecting people. Of the Son of Man, it says that this will be released tomorrow, the 12th, in Athens, and on the 19th in the provinces. All who are able, raise your voice before God, graciously, humbly, and with words that enlighten, because this leaves nothing untouched. The ideals of honor, morality, family, homeland, and faith are all growing cold. We must mobilize, yet no one steps forward. If you rally men and women, you may be able to accomplish something, but the men have become effeminate. They are lost. Nothing remains. We are lost. People say, "Leave it alone. We are not getting involved." However high we may rise economically, we will perish morally. Look abroad. People eat with golden spoons, yet they have become like beasts. Nothing sacred or holy remains. That is where we are heading, and we, the so-called Christians, are called to bring light into our own surroundings, each one of us. A woman visited me the other day. She had made a great effort to help her husband, who is Jewish, become a Christian. But what have you done about yourself? I see you immodestly dressed. I see your daughter wearing men's clothing. How is your husband to become a Christian? You yourself are heading toward hell. You will go to hell. You have cut your hair like a man. You are half naked, and you have cut your child's hair like a boy's. Where are you going? Where are we going? What place do such things have among us? Do you understand? If, then, we believe in Christ crucified, if we believe that, whether we like it or not, he will one day bring us to judgment, we must not wait for detailed instructions. Each of us must play our part. I cannot speak to everyone. Could you not go without an ice cream, buy a book instead, and leave it anonymously wherever you think it may help, wherever you feel led to stop? He keeps quiet for a week, and every bit of money he has he always gives for books. You have this joy of printing books for everyone, for each and every person, cheap and good. I'll write a few things for that myself. And then there are others, people with plenty of money, but they never put a hand in their pocket. We ought to ache for them and to love them. We don't love our own people. That word, love your enemies, simply isn't happening in us. The man who is still living far from God is an enemy of Christ. What have you done for him? And you yourself are an enemy of that man. What have you done? Nothing on the one side and nothing on the other. So we do have an obligation, I think, and he is waiting for it from us. We are not insignificant people. Through our prayer we have the power to prevail over all things. Through our life we have the power to shed light on all things, and to leave without excuse, with no defense at all, every one of those who say that Christianity is nothing. Christianity belonged to those times, they say. The gospel and Paul were speaking to that age. And yet, if even one person keeps the law of God, that person stands as a conviction, a living refutation, of all people in every age, showing that Christianity is true through and through. Therefore, for our part, just as we are always eager to pursue things that bring financial or worldly benefits, so too in this case we should do everything we can to enlighten others. Let us enlighten people, organize, make phone calls, send telegrams, write, do whatever we can, so that each person may preserve whatever can still be preserved. The time will come when even these faithful will be in danger of being lost altogether. The truly faithful are only 5 or 10 in 1,000. The rest of us are still lukewarm. Such a spiritual winter and such persecution will come that even those 5 or 10 will face it, but let us hope they will become martyrs. We must become active. Whether we or others will be saved, if we truly desire salvation, is in our hands. Christ is mighty. These are steps that Freemasonry has been planning for 200 or 300 years. They did not begin yesterday. If you read the protocols of the Elders of Zion, you will find various such claims there. All this, in my view, is the work of a hidden conspiracy. These are not new things. They have been carefully planned. Evil is organized. The Lord sees, and he will stretch out his hand. Whoever has compassion for their souls, whoever loves Christ, and whoever feels the pain that one ought to feel for every soul, let him act as he is enlightened to do. I do not intend to stir you up or make you go out shouting and so forth. No, let us pray. I only want you to understand that we are not what we imagine ourselves to be, even though we attend church or listen mainly to edifying words.